This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In a matter of months, the world has changed. COVID-19 has changed the way we live, and the pandemic's stay-at-home orders have brought maybe a welcome relief in many places from things like air pollution and the worsening environment. But that said, a global pandemic that is claiming people's lives shouldn't be seen as a way of bringing about environmental change either. So the call, of course, is to build back better. So when the pandemic eventually subsides, will carbon and pollutant emissions bounce back, or will we see changes in the way we do things? So joining me now to discuss this and more are Surin Suksuwan, a member of the IUCN World Commission on Protected Areas, and Preetha Shankar, an environmental lawyer. Welcome to both of you. How are you today?
Hi, Julia. Thank you very much. Doing very well. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah. Thanks for having me again on your show.
Yes, so we always meet up when there's some big things happening in the world. You know, usually it's post elections or post budget. And now here we are. Post MCO, I suppose we're in the recovery phase at the moment. But before the MCO was implemented, we had another huge change, of course, and that was the change in government. And a new cabinet was formed in early March. And of course, with that came reshuffling and, new ministries as well. So as far as the environment is concerned, portfolios seem to have changed as well. Maybe the both of you can help elaborate on the respective portfolios and, where we stand at the moment.
Right. Good question, Juliet. And it seems to be a little bit of a deja vu, right? We did talk about this.
Yes.
Yes. And you did talk to me and Surin about this, I think, shortly after the GE14.
That's right.
And we did lament about the fact that there was no clarity and rationale on the distribution of the environmental portfolio at that time. So it's a bit confronting that we are still talking about this again, barely 2 years later, and here we are again. But just for the listeners' benefit, when we say environment, I think it's good to kind of also understand that we're using this as a bit of a catch-all phrase. So when we say environment, it basically does entail those really big ticket subject matters like environmental pollution, and development mitigation, biodiversity, which looks at ecosystems and species, and energy and climate change. So it's a huge portfolio which we have encased into this and call it environment. So now I think it'd be good to see where we are with some of the ministries. And I think Surin can, it's hard to keep track. Really hard to keep track. But I think what we have now is the Ministry of Energy and Natural Resources. We have the Ministry of Water and Environment. And then I think we've reverted back to the good old days of the Ministry of Science and Tech. So this is what we have. And these are the three ministries that presumably now preside over those big issues that I mentioned earlier. But the real concern for me now is that with the realignment and with the distribution of the portfolios, we still don't know the questions that we asked 2 years ago. Where exactly do the synergies between these portfolios lie? So we can only assume that in essence, what's going to happen, and from experience, as this is going to still be a very siloed approach to things and how we tackle environmental issues and all of those other associated aspects. So just to give the listeners a bit of a rundown, in the last 20 years, the way the ministry's portfolios on the environment per se has changed is incredible. I mean, we've had the Ministry of Energy, Green Tech and Water at one point. Then we had the Ministry of Science, Tech and the Environment at one point. And that kind of devolved into the Ministry of Science, Tech and Innovation. Now innovation is nowhere in the picture when it comes to this whole gamut of environmental issues. And then I remember once upon a time, those of us who've been around long enough, we had the Ministry of Energy, Water and Communications, for example. And then we saw the introduction of the Ministry of Natural Resources. And then we had land being introduced into the portfolio. And then we had climate change. We had a juggernaut of a ministry previously known as MESTEC. So this kind of linking and delinking of portfolios really contributes to a lot of instability. And that's not something that we need to see as far as the environment is concerned. And post-COVID-19 and in our recovery, economic recovery trajectory, or even in terms of our sustainability goals, this lack of stability in the institutional structures is not something that we need to see continuing. I think I'll probably let Serene chime in on some of the evolving ministries we've seen in the last two decades.
Yeah, great job, Prita, in kind of recapping the various permutations of the ministry. To be honest, yeah. I'm still trying to grapple with the new configuration. And I think the ministry people themselves are probably, still in a bit of a daze, right?
Mm. Yes.
But yeah, I think there's just no way of getting a perfect kind of configuration, you know. Some people always say, well, you know, they should be in that ministry and all that, right? So to me, we can still make it work, but more importantly is the direction from the top. What are the kind of focus or emphasis that the minister is going to direct for his ministry? In this case, we don't know yet, right? The previous two ministers, I'm talking about the CATS minister and the Mass Tech minister, after a while, they sort of kind of latched on to certain things that maybe they felt very strongly about, right? So you had YBUB in, focusing on plastics, for example, and YB Arabia looking at tigers, for example. We don't know yet with the two ministers, but I'm hoping that they will at least fall back onto the policy documents that are already there, you know, the policy directions that have been agreed upon. So. Yeah. Key in terms of biodiversity conservation in the country would be national policy on biological diversity. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is a good piece of work. A lot of effort has been put into that. There are clear targets set, you know, aligned with SDGs and international kind of expectations. So what the ministries need to do would be to look back at these documents and get the directions from there, instead of just, you know, taking an ad hoc approach and just picking things that they think are interesting and running with it. So that remains to be seen.
And I think if I can just interject there, I think the issue, Juliet, is, and this is a concerning issue, that some government officials, when we have the change of portfolios or the distribution of portfolios amongst these three ministries and even more, they tend to refer to this as a rebranding exercise. And I've heard this being used a couple of times. This is not about rebranding a ministry. Certainly, it involves much more than what synonym you use to call the ministry, you know, from CATS or CATSA to MEWA or whatever that you want to call it. It's definitely not a superficial rebranding exercise. At the core of this is the fact that you have the way the institution works. How does an institution work when you de-link and link policies within the ministry and between ministries? I mean, I think this was a question we grappled with just after the GE14 when we came on your show 2 years ago. So I think the question we need to ask ourselves is, why is it when it comes to the environmental portfolio, we're still choosing to maintain this uneasy position of interchangeability, the preference in linking it now and de-linking it later, and then changing the operating assumptions in a way a ministry and all its underlings, which are all these agencies, work with one another and correlate to each other. So even for policies, as Surin mentioned, the BioD policy, for example, implementation suffers when you don't have institutional clarity. That's a fundamental issue in this country, especially when it comes to the environmental portfolio. So you can have a great piece of document, ambitious and aspirational, but it will not get implemented if you don't have these kinds of institutional structures. So I'm really worried that, you know, when we still go to the shifting change of portfolios, what we're doing is we're legitimizing this disorder. Hmm. We're continuing to legitimize this disorder. And we all know when our house is not in order, what we end up with. we totally end up with chaos. And that's not something we want to see going in or recovering or in a post-pandemic economy or a post-pandemic future. We certainly don't want to see unstable institutions trying to implement policies they don't know how to implement. That's a real concern.
Yeah, and you know, as you said, time is not on our side. You know, there is a greater, shall we call it, villain out there, right? There's the climate crisis. And, you know, considering that emissions have to fall by at least, what is it, 7.6% every year by 2050 to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees. I don't know, this internationally agreed target now feels alarmingly unachievable. And, you know, with all these changes, it doesn't seem like we, you know, as a nation are anywhere close to, you know, getting to that or focusing on an issue as big as this.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, it's absolutely. So if you want to tackle those big issues, climate change responses, whether that's mitigation or adaptation, Juliet, what I think we need to do is really come back to what I call institutional environmental imperatives. So when we set those imperatives within the institutions, then we can get an idea of what are our main priorities, whether that's BioD or climate change. Then we can get to the heart of some of the priorities and the implementing agencies. So now in the Malaysian context, those imperatives are really surrounded around mandate. Who's got the real mandate on climate change?
That's right.
You know, and what are the principles of operation when it comes to mitigation, when it comes to adaptation? What's the rationale for parking climate change within a particular ministry or agency? Mm. Is there coordination and is there overlap? These are the environmental imperatives, you know, when it comes to institutions. Once we sort that out, then we can begin to tackle some of the real issues of how we want to mitigate and how we want to adapt. So it really still boils down to the institutional structures and clarity on those issues and leadership, once again, within these institutions and at the higher level. And you're right, we don't have time to sit around and talk about this, but we need to talk about this. Otherwise, we're still looking at fragmented approaches and then everyone's looking around the room looking at, hey, whose issue is climate change, really? Because if you notice, the ministry doesn't carry that portfolio expressly now. Yeah. It's probably embedded within the Ministry of Water and Environment. But why is it not at the forefront? Why is it not at the front line of the ministries, you know? Mm. So is it being devalued in that sense? How does it look? So optics are really important as well when you talk about institutionally, you know, carving out something. The optics of how a ministry positions itself around portfolios is equally important, especially to the public. Hey, you know, they're looking at climate change. So there's really a need to revisit how we do institutional links and go from there.
Yeah, and something that I think the both of you might have mentioned as well, you know, that the environment needs to be part of all different portfolios in the government. You know, all different cabinets need to have an environmental targets or look at environmental aspects in the work that they do. Everything is interconnected in that sense.
Yes, absolutely. The question is, who's in charge?
Yeah.
Who's in charge of these real difficult, complex, integrated national type issue? Who's really, really in charge? And that hasn't, come to any clarity as such, at least not for me.
Mm-hmm. Sarin, anything you wanted to add to that, Sarin?
Yeah, I just want to pick on your earlier point, Juliet, about this kind of post-COVID situation, right? Mm. And of course, I think the main thing on everyone's mind right now is the health crisis. Given that scenario and given the instability as we have been talking about within the ministries that are involved in environmental issues and conservation, I think we will see a further dilution of the importance of environmental matters in this country because people are focused on tackling the COVID pandemic. And I think the budgets for environmental management is going to be slashed even further. So at the same time, you know, you also have other issues like the buildup of waste generated from the constant use of PPE. The only kind of small silver lining and that people seem to be talking about during the MCO is that, we see more wildlife coming out. But, you know, those are very very transient, you know,
yeah,
very short-term kind of effect, because once the traffic is back to what it was before and people are out and about again, the animals will go into hiding again. And worse still, maybe they are also being poached, because, you know, there are also some reports that enforcement activities have dropped during MCO because of various issues, right? And the poachers are probably back in the forest now and trapping the wildlife again. So these are some of the impacts that we can expect post-COVID. Yeah,
that's right. And that's a valid point that Surin raised about the instability, you know, Juliet, because if we looked at what's happened in Malaysia post-COVID, at least as far as the Ministry of Health is concerned, you would have seen that they've been able to really frame responses that have been directional and instructional, and it's integrated. God forbid, should we have an environmental crisis, I don't think with this multitude of jurisdictional issues and portfolio issues, we'd be able to coordinate this kind of an integrated response. That's the real issue here. So if an environmental crisis were to happen, I would be willing to bet that there'd be a lot of finger pointing about that's that department's jurisdiction, that's the federal government's responsibility, that's the state government's purview. This department didn't do that. That department didn't take care of that. We weren't allowed access into a forest reserve. This is going to be the kind of responses that we're going to get. We're not going to get the kind of responses we've seen in tackling the COVID-19 from a health perspective in the country. And that's worrying. It lends back to the issue of why, you know, institutional stability is really important.
Yeah, and I think another thing that's also suffering in this post-pandemic world, or I mean in this world of where we're facing the pandemic now, is that, you know, things like ecotourism is also suffering, and, you know, that's also leading into slashes and conservation work is actually also coming to a halt. You know, people aren't able to go and conduct field research and things like that. Surin, is there anything you want to talk about with regard to that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of confusion still with regard to ecotourism, and, you know, I've got friends who are involved in the ecotourism industries, who are hikers, and they like going to the forest, and there are a lot of things that are not clear right now, right? Because on the one hand, you can go to a public park, right? You can go to a public park. I can't quite remember the SOP now. Certain numbers of people at one time, blah blah blah, but you can't actually do those kind of outdoor activities in a forest. At least not at the level that we had before. And again, I'm not too sure as well whether you can do that. Seems like you can do it as a day trip. You can go into the forest on a day trip, but not stay overnight. So what if you have a lodge or a resort in the forest? Can that resort operate? Because hotels are allowed. Hotels in the cities are allowed. But if it's in the forest, it seems like you can't, because people then will end up overnighting in a forest. So these are some of the challenges. But, you know, it's quite interesting because during the MCO, we had also various webinars going on. There was one done by Professor Amran, who is a leading expert on tourism, local tourism, nature-based tourism, and so on. And, you know, his take on it was that, you know, because of COVID, people are going to avoid mass tourism, right? And maybe there might be a shift towards ecotourism. But if the situation is prolonged, some of these ecotourism facilities are going to shut down, and we're already seeing some of that happening. So, you know, we might not even have those kind of ecotourism activities available for people soon, right? Except for self-organized kind of activities. Yes, you can go to your neighborhood forest in the backyard, and you probably don't need to get a guide or book a accommodation, but some of the operators are actually operating in national parks, and they are facing a real problem in terms of making their business viable.
Yeah. I'm speaking today to Preeta Shankar. She's an environmental lawyer, and Surin Suksuwan, who is a member of the IUCN World Commission on Protected Areas. And we're talking about, you know, the impacts that the pandemic has had on the environment. And also in Malaysia, you know, how the change of government and the ministry portfolios with regard to the environment, you know, where do we stand now? You know, how do we move forward? We need some clarity. So we're discussing this and more, and we're going to continue this discussion after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today are Preetha Shankar. She's an environmental lawyer, and Surin Sukhsuwan. He is a member of the IUCN World Commission on Protected Areas. And we're talking about the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on the environment. And, you know, just before the break, we were talking about, you know, some of the effects that the pandemic has brought in terms of, you know, lowered emissions and, you know, whether that's actually something that can be sustainable. And we were also talking about some of the problems that have arisen in terms of environmental conservation, you know, with regard to the pandemic. But, you know, on the flip side, of course, there are also opportunities that have arisen from this pandemic, you know. Mm. And of course, the call, as I mentioned in my intro, was to build back better. Do you agree that this is this great pause, you know, as they call it, has given us a chance to do that, to build back better?
I think it has. It's a question of whether we now avail ourselves to the opportunities. On the issue of building back better and opportunities, I think, Juliet, it's more, I think, evident on scale. So what I mean by that is, if you look at the individual level or the family level, and even at the community level, I think people are a lot more aware that they have a great capacity for change. They have a great capacity for change, and that they're able to now, I think, keep the momentum of how life can be a little bit more sustainable and low carbon. I have faith that people will continue to practice this. But at the government level, I'm not so sure. I'm not really seeing some of the messaging that's coming out on the environment. It's been really quiet. We haven't seen a lot of the messaging or what they perceive or see as the opportunities to do better or to build back better in terms of sustainability has been. I have been seeing a lot of articles and opinions by a lot of scholars and experts on this issue. They've talked about how we have flattened the curve on the infection rates, but possibly now we have to shift that towards flattening, for example, the emissions curve or flattening the consumption curve or the degradation of bio-D and ecosystem degradation curve. You know, so that's the language that people are tending to use now, and that this can actually be done. But you really need to scale it up when it comes to the environmental sustainability issues. But I think if we bring it down to the government level, the issue is really an opportunity to reflect. Really reflect on how we want to recover and revive the economy in the short term, and for the longer term, how do we actually want to achieve prosperity? So this is really back to the basics and a deep dive into how we really want to tackle sustainability issues in the country. So I think that's the opportunity that's really arisen here. So post-pandemic, despite all the budget deficits or the cuts to conservation that's probably bound to happen, despite possibly the worst recession we're going to see in a long time, any economic recovery trajectory really has to keep the environmental issues really high on the political agenda, now more so than ever. I don't think there's a differing opinion on this. People might think it's counterintuitive now to talk about, you know, investing in the environment. It really isn't. This is the time to really talk about this and do this. But I appreciate the fact, you know, Julie, it's easy to say, oh, how does something, you know, come to be high on the set of priorities, or how does it find its place on the agenda politically, or, you know, even from a policy perspective? And I think what we've learned from COVID-19, or what we can learn from COVID-19, is the positioning of the issue. If we've positioned this issue in terms of sustainability post-COVID, I would think that the way to position this now would be in terms of vulnerability, because that's something that we've learned from the pandemic and in the post-pandemic recovery stage. What the pandemic has basically laid bare is how societies are vulnerable, economies, whether that's a family economy or whether that's a business economy, how vulnerable they are, the healthcare system, the supply chain vulnerability. So everything's encased in this aspect of vulnerability and how resilient we are as a society economically, in demand chains, in supply chains, and so forth. why that's happened is because all these issues, whether it's the health, mental health, or access to hospitals and supplies and paychecks and all those other issues, is because we've had a watershed moment. But we haven't had that, you know, thankfully, in the environmental realm. And we cannot wait for it to happen before we decide how are we going to tackle the vulnerabilities when it comes to environmental resilience and ecosystem resilience. So I think that repositioning the environmental issues in terms of vulnerability might be one way to go. And that's an opportunity we have to take to have that discussion now, at least in terms of setting the priorities in this recovery stage.
Surin, what about you? Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree with Preeta that building ecosystem resilience, focusing on natural resources management, I mean, those are things that need to be done. But I guess I'm a little bit more pessimistic that the government will actually do what it should do.
Right.
You know, because I think that the overriding thing would be getting the economy to recover. Yeah. And I think that will be above everything else, right?
Yes.
And there was even a recent news article, I can't remember which minister said that, about, oh, let's exploit our mineral resources, right? Because we can raise X billion of ringgit by, you know, digging up those minerals from the soil. So, yeah, that makes me worried. But, you know, let's remember that it's not just about the government, right? Mm. There's civil society, there's, you know, actions by individuals, right? So I'm a little bit more optimistic about that. And I think there are many opportunities there, right, for people to innovate, to adopt more sustainable lifestyle, to create new movements, new initiatives, and you know, working with like-minded parties, adopting technology. I think there's a lot of space for that, and people are actually constantly finding ways to build it better, as you said, Juliet. But it's not necessarily driven by the government. I think that individual action and non-governmental organizations can take the lead in that respect. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's important. I mean, it's also important to make sure, I don't know how we're going to ensure this, and I suppose that's where the role for civil society really comes in, that they should still emphasize on, you know, sustainability being at the heart of any economic response. Mm. So I'm also worried sometimes, probably not as pessimistic as Surin, but still worried, because, I mean, recently, I think the government announced that they are fully waiving the sales tax for locally assembled vehicles, and there's a 50% reduction on sales tax for fully imported cars. I mean, in this time, I mean, yes, you're looking to revive the, you know, the automotive sector and so on. But when you talk about sustainability, do you really want to see more cars on the road?
That's right.
Right? Do you really want to see more cars on the road? And then you have already vulnerable people out there who are tempted, who are really tempted to buy that imported car right now, without knowing if they're going to be able to pay for this next year, you know, for when another crisis hits. So on all accounts, when you start putting sustainability, whether that's a personal or environmental sustainability, some of the announcements just don't seem to make sense. They're almost paradoxical to what we're going through at the moment. So that's really worrying.
Yeah. And I mean, are there also concerns about lowering environmental standards, you know, or other related measures in a post-pandemic economy? Like, how can we ensure that, you know, COVID-19 is, you know, this pandemic is not used as an excuse to weaken environmental protection and enforcement?
I mean, there are concerns, of course. I mean, we are seeing that happen very early in the recovery phase, once, you know, people are lumbering out of, you know, lockdowns. We can see that happening already, I think, in some instances in India and Canada. But just so that the audience understands, Juliet, when we talk about lowering environmental standards or we're relaxing measures related to the environment, we tend to put this in this thing called deregulation of the environment in that sense. Mm-hmm. And there's an objective behind it. The idea behind the deregulation is to reduce the red tape, or in this case, the green tape, so that, you know, projects and economic activities can be, you know, initiated really very quickly, or to reduce costs that are, you know, associated with compliance, or both, a bit of both. So there is a fear of that happening. The question is, how do we look out for it? It's a bit difficult. It's a bit difficult to do because it doesn't always happen in a way that it flares up in your face and say, oh, no more compliance with EIAs from tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen like that. It's unlikely to happen in that way. How that can happen in the Malaysian context needs a little bit of understanding. It can happen in the way legislations embed, for example, exemptions. Exemptions to doing something, exempting persons or class of persons from a particular requirement. You find that in the EQA, you find it in CITES-related regulations. You have standards that you don't need to comply with. You can dispense with public participation. You have gazette notifications that become more obscure than they are now, for example. You know, you don't attach conditions to licensing requirements, for example. So these things happen very, very insidiously. So it doesn't necessarily happen right there for you to be able to tackle it. So that's something that might happen, but we may not be aware that it's actually happening. How do we ensure that it doesn't happen? To be honest, I don't have the answer to that, Juliet. I really don't have an answer. But I think civil society and individuals who are in the know, who are aware that this might be some of the ways in which deregulation can happen, at least in the short term, have to remain vigilant about it. You really have to, you know, remain vigilant, and you have to promote activism in a way that says you don't take away the necessary processes, especially when they're science-linked processes or they involve governance. So it's important to know that it might be happening on the sly. You know, it doesn't necessarily happen by a big lobby or, you know, that there's a lot of hue and cry over it. It can happen very, very quietly. And that's something we need to be aware of, a possibility out there.
Yeah, and this lowering of standards, you know, then it doesn't necessarily happen just within Malaysia, within the country. Mm-hmm. Because, it's also happening across the supply chain. So one example of this, which I thought was really pertinent, happening during the COVID pandemic, is the market for our natural rubber product, specifically rubber gloves, right? And we know that rubber gloves are kind of like a must for fighting the pandemic, right? There was even a shortage of rubber gloves at one time, right? So prior to the pandemic, the US government was actually putting more restrictions against rubber gloves entering the US market because there were concerns mainly on the social side of things, the treatment of workers and all that. But there were also some environmental concerns related to the production of rubber coming from this region.
Right.
And they were starting to really put our business practices under scrutiny. But because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the US government then decided that, okay, let's just forget about these restrictions because we need the gloves now. So, I mean, that's just one example, right? Yeah. But we can probably predict that more of these kind of things will be happening. The pandemic has caused economies to suffer. There's increased poverty. So people will tend to extract more resources, right? The environment, right? So maybe they need more timber, they need more the oil and gas or whatever resources. That might actually lead to a lowering of standards that, you know, maybe the regulators will not be as strict in terms of ensuring that sustainability requirements are met. So,
absolutely, yes.
But, you know, just bringing together everything that we've been discussing, you know, the government especially, and also I want to talk about the corporate sector, you know, in what ways can they, you know, the government and corporate sector, how can they improve environmental sustainability and resilience in a post-pandemic world? And I guess, you know, why should they as well?
I think I'm going to let Serene take this one first. He might have a better perspective.
I talked about what they should do earlier, right? Yeah. Building resilience and, you know, addressing some of the underlying factors, you know, making sure that, you know, the ecosystems are robust enough to withstand not just the pandemic, but other global crises, you know, like climate change, that's still there, you know, it hasn't gone away just because the pandemic, right? We still need to do what we've identified that needs to be done, right? We've got all these climate adaptation plans, we've got the biodiversity policy, all these things. So I'm not suggesting anything new, actually. I'm saying that we need to go back to these plans, not forget about them. But maybe there could be some things that we could improve because of what we've learned from the pandemic, right? Maybe some of the projections in terms of consumption may have changed. So maybe we need to relook at some of those figures. But otherwise, I mean, the overall game plan shouldn't change. I think we should still pressure the government to do what they're supposed to do. And that is, you know, taking care of the environment so that human well-being and the economy will also be taken care of ultimately. Yeah.
Yes, I think, Juliet, Surin's answered that question, but I think in a nutshell is that the corporate sector will have to now be more socially responsible than ever because, you know, there is a collective good here as opposed to, you know, any PR type exercises or to be in compliance with particular standards. There's a collective good right now, you know, that they need to take heed of. If we don't do well, the corporate sector don't do well. That's been very, very clear. So there's a lot of investments that's still needed. That's investment in technology, perhaps really a reevaluation of how the company or the corporate sector has designed their own sustainability efforts in the past, and to try and see if those efforts have really had any impact or not. And if they're going to invest in money, really what kind of programs and initiatives and collaborations are really going to bring about some kind of solution. So I think a real kind of re-look into corporate strategies when it comes to sustainability issues is something that, you know, is needed, you know, in a post-pandemic world. So you have to now start talking about sustainability in a different context. You're really responding to what's happening outside as opposed to previously maybe responding to other pressures and standards and bad press and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But now there is an issue of there's a collective good at stake here. And then we really have to look at where best can we invest our money and our efforts. So that's the role for the corporate sector, I would think.
Yeah. And, you know, whatever gains that we have achieved or we've received in this time, you know, if governments and the corporate sector, if they fail to push ahead with decisive change, then I guess everything is pretty much squandered in that sense.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, especially the opportunities that have arisen to learn some lessons from this pandemic. Mm. I mean, that would be really lost if we didn't take the chance now to really tackle some of the issues that we are being confronted with. Would we have similar problems when we have an environmental crisis in the future? Are we looking at sustainability with the right lens in that sense, you know? So how do we prioritize? So it's good to talk about policies, and we do have a couple of good ones. But I really think it would do well if we looked into a prioritization exercise as well. What would be the five biggest issues that Malaysia needs to tackle both at the government level, the corporate level, and at a societal level in the next 5 years? We can't possibly implement everything in the policy document that Surin referenced just now, the National Bio-D Policy. So it would be good to revisit that and see what the top priorities would be in this recovery, in this post-pandemic economic recovery stage as well. So the priorities have been shifted slightly. So I would think that it's now shifting towards looking at resilience a lot more than we have in the past.
I'm afraid we're running out of time, but is there any last message that, you know, the both of you would like to leave us with? Maybe, Surin, I don't know if you want to have a more, a less, what is the word you used just now?
Pessimistic.
A less pessimistic one. But no, I mean, no.
Don't get me wrong. I mean,
Not at all. I'm with you on that.
I think that, you know, to me, it's not down to any single person or single entity, right? So, I'm somewhat pessimistic about the government because I understand that they still have to win this COVID battle. It's far from over. We've still got a long road ahead. So they will be caught up with that. Yeah. And also then they have to focus on economic recovery. So I think that, you know, we need to look beyond these institutions. I think we need to look at individual action and civil society action. and I remain optimistic that that people will actually innovate and build it better, as you said, Juliet. Yeah.
And Preetha, any last message you'd like to leave us with?
Simply that I think, you know, if there's anything to be learned from, you know, what we've come out of and as we go into the recovery stage for the environment, is that we really work better when we find solutions together. So I think for the government, I think continue to reach out to civil society and experts and academics and scientists, conservationists, all of these collectively can try, you know, we can try to find some solutions to some of the problems that we are having, and try not to think that there's nothing to be gained by engaging with civil society and individuals and experts in their field. And I'm sure we can come up with some solutions that that could possibly work, depending on what it is that we're trying to address. So I think that Kita Jaga Kita, you know, slogan that's been going on really has to be extended to more collaborative issues, that we all look out for each other and try to work together to find the solutions as far as the environmental issues are concerned. That's my wish list, I think.
All right. Thank you so much to the both of you for joining me today. I've been speaking to Preetha Shankar. She's an environmental lawyer. And Surin Suksuwan, he is a member of the IUCN World Commission on Protected Areas. And we were discussing, well, in many ways, we're discussing how we can build back better following this pandemic. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.